all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web. VeteransRadio.org is our new URL, VeteransRadio.org, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to VeteransRadio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at LegalHelpForVeterans.com. Two interesting stories today. We're going to talk to Allison Jaslow, who is the CEO of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, better known as IAVA. And then we're going to talk to Brigadier General Doug Otis Slocum, who is the president of Michigan Air and Space Forces Association. So that's part of a national organization as well. So you're going to get a real national perspective. But first, we're going to start with Allison Jaslow. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Allison Jaslow, who is the CEO of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, better known as IAVA. Allison, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're thrilled to have the CEO of IAVA on and talk about a number of issues, but let's sort of set this up a little bit. How did a nice kid like you, who graduated from the University of Central Missouri and Wentworth Military Academy under ROTC scholarships, end up in the U.S. Army?
Well, the Army was a dream of mine when I was a kid. Starting when I was 13, I went on a career day field trip. In fact, I regularly draw attention to the fact that I'm the only success story of career day that I know of, and that's still the case. But I, you know, it was a year where at my school, you went on a field trip, and I picked a bunch of other places to go. You know, because when you're 13, you want to go to the place where you can get some free stuff or maybe some food. But ended up at Fort Myer, which is the military base that's connected to Arlington National Cemetery. And from that day on, because the sort of ceremonial aspect of Fort Myer swept me off my feet, I had wanted to be in the Army ever since. In fact, the dream and goal, because I like to aim high, at the time, the Army had yet to have its first four-star woman general. So that was like the path that I thought I was going to walk in my life, was join the Army however, which way I could do it, and, you know, climb until, you know, hopefully I could reach the pinnacle of service in the Army. Went to school, as you noted, on an ROTC scholarship. I began school the fall of 2000. So, of course, my sophomore year was when September 11th happened. And, of course, the trajectory of my career changed fundamentally. You know, I went in eyes wide open knowing that I could go to war someday. But, of course, you know, our country and our military has dealt with a lot ever since. But despite deploying twice to Iraq, you know, it wasn't deployments that ultimately made me want to get out, but just some of the challenges that I faced while I was in the military. But also, I had this sort of instinct or intuition that I could maybe make a better impact or a greater impact for the greater good of my country and on my fellow countrymen if I actually did so out of uniform. And so in the years since, I have crisscrossed the country, you know, dabbling in political campaigns and serving in a number of roles in government, to include in the White House and on Capitol Hill. And I like to say that, you know, what I do today is sort of the perfect marriage of the skill sets I have learned post-service and then also my identity as a veteran myself, because I now have the great privilege of advocating on behalf of a generation of veterans that I belong to and a community that I belong to, on the national stage, in the media, and in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, you really do have a great blend of talent and experience for that. The work that was done on the staff of several members of Congress and then in the White House communications area sort of helps set all of that up so that you can, you know, walk the halls and talk to folks and know how they think and how they react to certain challenges that they face. But before we get a little deeper here, I want to talk to folks about what your experiences in Iraq were about. And you exited, I don't know the years, I guess I didn't track the years down, but you were in from when to when, and I know your terminal rank was as a captain in the Army.
Yeah, so I was sworn in to active duty upon graduation in May of 2004, went to my officer basic course in June of 2004, graduated in September, and by the day after Thanksgiving of that year, was on a plane to Kuwait before heading north into Iraq. I served just under a year during that deployment. I was actually attached to a reserve unit from your neck of the woods. It was a reserve unit that drew from across the Midwest, but was based in Bay City, Michigan. Was able to get my platoon leader time running that platoon. And what we had originally deployed with was a warehousing mission. I had four different warehousing operations that I was the accountable officer for. But within 60 days, all the warehouses but one were contracted out to Kellogg, Brown, and Root. And so my platoon then became both a force protection platoon and a which included not just only base force protection, but also convoy security. And so my platoon, myself included, did convoys up and down Iraq and provided basically the convoy security element in between, whether it was, you know, regular petroleum tankers or flatbed trucks, you name it. You know, on a battlefield where those particular trucks aren't as agile as the gun trucks were, but that there were, you know, basically IEDs everywhere. I came home stateside to Fort Carson, Colorado, for a little over a year after that, and then deployed again in January 2007, which was just ahead of the surge being announced. And so I was overseas for about 15 months that time. I served on battalion staff for that particular deployment. And that one was at, you know, Camp Liberty or the Baghdad International Airport. And my first deployment was to Taji, Iraq.
Well, one of the things you learned in that first deployment is that responsibilities shift and change, and you just roll with whatever the next assignment is. And that's certainly been the case in your post-military career. You've had a lot of interesting assignments. And now this most recent one here in 2023 as CEO of IAVA. Why don't you tell our listeners, and maybe there's some who are not familiar with what the work and the mission of IAVA is.
So IAVA is the leading advocacy organization for the post-9/11 generation of veterans. In fact, we're commonly referred to as the leading voice of the post-9/11 generation of veterans. But essentially, we are storytellers that tell the story of our generation, whether that's our needs or also our successes. And oftentimes, you know, doing that work best in class means we are telling that story and shaping that narrative in the media with the hopes of influencing public opinion, with the hopes of then influencing public policy action. IAVA you know, counts among its achievements the passage of the post 9/11 GI Bill, the Clay Hunt Suicide Prevention Act, which was named after one of our member advocates who died by suicide, and also laws passed very recently, like the PACT Act, which helps veterans get care for exposure to toxins, which is a variety of different toxins over a number of generations. But, you know, IAVA really did spark the conversation around burn pits exposure, which are unique to our particular generation.
Well, certainly one of the aspects of IAVA is it's sort of a different veterans organization than maybe the traditional nationally chartered ones like VFW, VVA, which came out of a specific generation. Talk to us about how IAVA is intentionally a different type of organization.
Well, our founder is usually the first to point out that we are the first digitally native veterans organization. We don't have it anymore, but IAVA had a MySpace page back when MySpace was a thing. but you know, our generation, first of all, we are much fewer in numbers, but we're not congregating necessarily in Legion halls. And so we are more connected online than anywhere else, whether it's in a Facebook page, whether it's, you know, on a group text between battle buddies, or a group chat of some sort. And so I think that's one way that makes us unique, both where our constituency is living and breathing, but also that we are uniquely capable of existing online. You know, IAVA, I feel like, has been a disruptor, you know, especially in Washington, D.C., in a way that has been necessary. And I think this is actually makes us similar to the VVA. You know, we stand in solidarity with other generations of veterans, but we're there to make sure that, like, our generation's needs don't get overlooked, which is, you know, ever more important because we're much smaller in numbers. And I think, you know, organizational posture aside, something that also makes us a unique voice is that we're the only major national veterans organization that represents exclusively volunteers. You know, every person who served in Iraq and Afghanistan or the other, you know, areas post 9/11 that we are still actually deploying troops to fight today, they all stepped up to serve and did so willingly. Some of them deployed, like myself, multiple times, and we have very unique needs for that reason. And I think, you know, you and I were talking about this before we jumped on. I think that puts us in a unique position to also advocate around issues like the recruiting crisis, you know, and what we should be doing to make sure that we have a healthy all-volunteer force, because we are veterans who were all volunteers, whereas, you know, some of the other organizations definitely have a mix, right?
And I think it's a it just made sense that this evolved, IAVA evolved into this position, because you referenced VVA, Vietnam Veterans Association, had to do the same thing for their generation of folks to try to get heard for their issues. So this organization for the veterans who've served since post 9/11, and, you know, we've just only within the last year or so ended a 20-year war, IAVA has this unique responsibility to that group of veterans, which they're with their own set of issues. And certainly it's a more digital, more comfortable on the internet sort of group, more of an online sort of group. And one of the things that you've done with that is, and I think this helps you become a better policy advocate, is when you have data, when walking mm-hmm. the halls of Congress. This is probably one of those things you learned because of your experiences on Capitol Hill and in the White House communication. But IAVA went out and surveyed its members about issues. Can we talk about the 2023 IAVA member survey?
Sure. You know, I think over time, IAVA has done two things really well with our data, which is comprised of, you know, over 425,000 members and supporters, and some of which are verified veterans. In other words, like, you haven't even just self-identified, but we have paperwork that says you are 100% a vet. So when you're responding to our surveys, we know for a fact we've seen your DD-214 or we've seen your VA card, et cetera. And we have been able to field the most comprehensive non-governmental survey of our generation. But we also do what I like to call flash polls, which is what we did over the summer to just gauge where our membership was on some of the issues of the day, which, you know, it's funny, people will like to pigeonhole us on just veterans issues, right? But veterans are like everybody. They have opinions about other issues of the day. And I think that we believe that it's important that the veteran voice is heard as a part of other conversations as well.
You could say we are people too. Yeah.
Yes, I know. I will tell you, a great deal of my advocacy is, I was actually at a conference last week where I highlighted this. I was like, we aren't this, like, you can't look at the veterans population and like put us over in this corner as though, like, you know, all the vets are there. It's like, we are both veterans and part of like a variety of other constituency groups, you know, and we are everywhere in terms of like geography, socioeconomic status, you know.
One of the things you did in your poll, and I think this was interesting because you know, folks in the military say, hey, we're the last ones who want war. We are peacekeepers. We know the cost of war. We're not, you know, warmongers. And one of the questions you asked folks was about authorization of use of military force. I thought that was an interesting statistic. Talk to us about it.
Well, actually, nothing unifies our membership more than a desire to see the 2001 and 2002 authorizations of military force either repealed or reformed. They've been open-ended since they were passed to authorize, you know, retaliation for 9/11 and then also to go into Iraq. And frankly, those open-ended authorizations have been exploited by administration after administration. And I think two things. You're right in the sense that members of the military, because they understand the consequences of wars more so than people who aren't emotionally connected to it, are perhaps more inclined to be more thoughtful and judicious when we even go to war. But more importantly, political leaders should be doing the same, right? And so I think the beginning and end of the AUMF isn't saying that, like, nobody still, you know, doesn't want to fight terrorism, you know, where we have troops deployed right now in Syria and Iraq. There may be a very good reason why troops are deployed there to, you know, make sure that ISIS doesn't get out of control or fill in the blank other threat that we're fighting across the globe right now. But what we do owe those troops and what we do owe their families is to have a constant conversation about where they're going, under what terms, and what for what purpose. And we're not having that conversation. At least Congress isn't, and that is like their most solemn responsibility. In effect, they've been abdicating the responsibility to our troops and their families for, you know, going on decades.
Well, as you say, that open-ended authorization, 85%. Agreed or strongly agreed that ought to be reduced or eliminated. Again, that was probably the highest thing everybody agreed on this 550 or so verified veterans that were surveyed. Another one that's, you know, in the news is how your members felt about Ukraine and the U.S. involvement in Ukraine. Again, not as high, not 85%, but 67% either agreed with U.S. involvement strongly or agreed to it. So while there is experience, there's also understanding that if you don't do something, the bad guys always win, right? So that led me to your results on China, which is something I worry about. Talk to us how your members felt about the China situation.
I mean, a majority of IVA members, you know, over 50%, indicated that they are only partly confident in the ability of the U.S. to deal with threats from China. And 30% don't believe that we're prepared at all. So to your earlier point, even if vets and IAVA veterans specifically want sort of checks and balances on how and when we go to war and how we combat threats, and or want, you know, political leadership specifically to be thinking through how and when we go to war, they also want to make sure that we are, you know, protected for the threats of the future. And honestly, China is a good example. Like, if we effectively protect ourselves from the threats, we could also avoid a war with China.
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. And your members, certainly the early ones in Iraq, went there with unarmored vehicles, right? We weren't ready for it at all. And you don't, you know, I know the slogan was you fight the war with what the equipment you've got, but that just showed poor planning, poor thinking ahead. And I kind of read this result where 30% of the survey says, hey, we're not ready. We're leading ourselves back into a situation where once, if it does happen, we're going to have folks in unarmored vehicles, if you will. So it's an interesting observation, I think, from folks who've been there and done that.
Well, and I also think our generation, to your point about up-armored vehicles, it's not just like up-armored vehicles, like the enemy was always one step ahead of us. And so we needed to be able to innovate in real time. And I think our generation has sort of lived seeing how the DoD is not very good at doing that. You know, the DoD is still very much like in their procurement process is still very much stuck in the olden days of being able to, like, you know, plan out for wars and certain timelines that we just can't, you know, we need to be able to move and shake like they do in Silicon Valley to keep up with war fighting these days. And I don't know that our government and the bureaucracy is totally there. And I think that our generation of veterans has a unique appreciation for that. And I think that would give us a higher anxiety level when it comes to like fighting the threats of the future, you know?
It is, again, one of those things where you say, boy, I hope somebody's planning the right way on this stuff and we don't get caught short. And you can hear a lot of that about, does the Navy really have enough ships? Do we have the right types of ships? Do we have the right technology to be able to fight China in the... on the seas and by the Philippines and down by Taiwan and Australia. It's a big theater to fight in, a much different theater than the desert, much different theater than urban warfare we're seeing in Ukraine. So you've got to think about it a different way. I want to move to another part of your survey, which was domestic policy, because this is something that I've certainly anecdotally noticed every time I talk on the issue of cannabis on Veterans Radio. But talk to us a little bit about what you found in terms of support on legalizing cannabis.
Well, you know, I'd say from the jump that something that your listeners need to remember is our generation of veterans has lived through the opioid crisis. And so whether it's cannabis, or other forms of alternative therapies, our generation is more eager to get access to alternative therapies than generations of the past. So that's the first thing. And something we have advocated for some time is at minimum research into cannabis and its healing properties, not just for managing your PTSD, but maybe also chronic pain. Because we do know that there are veterans who are benefiting from use of cannabis, you know, products, but also because it is being legalized in many states across the country, which I'm sure your listeners have seen on the landscape. But the reality is if you get your care through the VA in a state that's legalized it, your VA doctor still can't prescribe it to you or even say, you know, I can prescribe you this medication or that medication, or I can't prescribe you cannabis, but you do live in a state where it's available and some veterans have seen positive effects from using cannabis for their PTSD or positive effects for using cannabis to relieve their back pain after, you know, two different deployments with a bunch of gear on and convoys. And so our members more than, I'm looking at the data right now, but it's an overwhelming number of our members would like to see legalization at the national level because it's holding back veterans who want to get access to this care. I mean, we have one of our veteran leaders who lives in Indiana and regularly drives to Illinois to access cannabis products that he pays for on his own dime after spending time and gas money to go get the cannabis that has really helped his PTSD specifically. And I think our fellow vets, even if you don't want to use cannabis yourself, you don't want your buddies like having to bend over backwards to get something that says that they, or that they tell you really makes an improvement in their quality of life.
And usually somebody's, by the time they've gotten there, they've gone through all the prescription drugs and other treatments that the VA can prescribe.
Yep.
It was only 10% of the polling that was opposed or strongly opposed to legalizing it. Everybody else fell in the, 90% or something, 85% fell in the supporting legalization of cannabis. And we really need to, the federal government needs to get on with this in part because so that the VA can say, we've done the research and these drugs and this cannabis use has interactions, doesn't have interactions, and we can put some strength and dosages issues and around it. I mean, I think that's part of what's missing and part of what you were commenting on. We just need to do more research, don't we?
Definitely. And I think, what you're speaking to is sort of the broader like conversation around regulation period. Like there is positive incentive to even people who aren't cannabis fans to, because of where we are right now, both in cultural acceptance and legalization state by state, to just get the federal government there. Because once you do, then we know that everybody's going to be using safe cannabis. To your point, they'll be using the right amount of dosage because we'll have research behind it and we'll be able to give people that information. Because nobody would want to, if the purpose is to improve your quality of life, then you want the right amount of dosage to be able to do that versus, just shooting from the hip. Right. But lots of people, to your point, who have already tried and not found success with pills and, or, there are people who've taken pills and then, maybe got it addicted to them and like don't want to keep taking them and they would want another therapy because of, what opioids are doing to some people these days, then why wouldn't we want to be able to, at this moment in time, regulate an industry and change the laws so people can get access to what is already very readily available, but also in the right quantity and dosage that's fit for whatever condition they have, And research will get you there, my friend.
it will, and I think this problem will solve itself. It's just taking too long. We'll come back and talk some more with the CEO of IAVA, but a few words from our sponsors.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit veteranscrisisline.net. Veteranscrisisline.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Allison Jaslow, who is the CEO of IAVA, about their 2023 member survey. We still have a few more items there. And then we've got a couple of other areas we want to cover about women veterans and recruiting issues. Allison, one of the things that you, I think, busted open in your data here was the, we were joking about it earlier, we're all people too, so not all veterans of the IAVA era, if you will, vote one way or the other way. They're not all woke, and they're not all strict right-wing conservatives. I thought the statistics here were there were particularly interesting because it helped demonstrate or prove what I think most of us knew anyway. It's not a monolithic block. So tell us what your results on elections got you.
Yeah, I mean, what I like to say is the veteran vote is a jump ball, at least among IAVA members. I mean, we're about a third Democrat, a third Republican, and a third, you know, not overly impressed with either party. So I think that also flies in the face, I think, of what a lot of people's assumptions would be about the veteran population.
Yes, yes.
You know, again, our generation is unique. I like to say, I feel like, you know, we're a combination largely of millennials and Gen Z. Of course, there are other people who serve or other veterans who've served post 9/11 who don't count themselves as a part of those generations. But, you know, the median IVA member is actually the same age as I am, is 41. But I think most people of, you know, our age and generation are more either small P progressive or libertarian than maybe you'd find in other generations. And so I think they're more than anything else looking for a candidate that can, I don't know, match their values and are probably open to somebody who's outside of the traditional box that we've been fed in the past.
Well,
but it'll be interesting to see specifically, and this is something that's important to me leading our organization, is like the candidates need to be speaking to us, or they will risk losing a very important because it's a reliable voting block. You know?
In that regards, 88% or so said they will vote in the 2024 election without question.
There you go.
So
right?
That's a high percentage of folks said, hey, I've done my job here serving. I'm going to make sure I vote on who's there. But it was, as you say, a jump ball on presidential candidates and Democrats and Republicans, sort of split right down, you know, into thirds. And so I'm not, you know, this far out, I'm not sure it tells us a whole lot. But it does tell us they're going to go out and vote. So, yes, I agree the candidates ought to be speaking with IAVA members and veterans in general, and not just lip service, which we get all too much of at election times, don't we?
Yeah, and I think our generation specifically is kind of over it. You know, a lot of my contemporaries, their entire adult lives have been shaped by elected leaders failing us. And so I think the hunger right now is for real, authentic leadership. I think not just among our generation of veterans, but I think we're hopefully getting to a tipping point where the American electorate is going to demand it too. You know, I think people have talked like they've really wanted it, but haven't necessarily voted that way. And then I think that this is an exciting time for our generation of veterans, because I think we're well positioned to step in and be those leaders now. You know, it's taken some time for, whether it's in the private sector or the public sector, for, you know, many of us to actually build up a resume, to be quote unquote qualified or, you know, worthy of elected office at this point. But I think we're really hitting a moment when it comes to some of the best among us being in positions to lead us forward. And that actually gives me hope these days.
No, that's good. That's a good point. We're talking to Allison Jaslow, who's the CEO of IAVA and an Army captain, served a couple of times over in Iraq, and certainly at a time when women veterans weren't always treated the same, or women military members, service members weren't always treated the same as their male counterparts. So being in this position of leadership at IAVA, I think, helps communicate the value and that there are women veterans out there. But you probably experienced that, Allison, where women weren't in combat units there, technically, although everywhere in Iraq was a combat unit, essentially, and you didn't get the same sort of awards and decorations as male counterparts. And sometimes that can impact competitive promotions or other career opportunities. So this is this having the badge of CEO gives you a sort of a leg up to talk to folks about some of these distinctions, doesn't it?
It sure does. You know, I think we've come a long way since when I served. Women can now, you know, serve in combat designated roles, which even though I'm here to say, you know, there were bullets flying over the convoys I was riding in, and there were also IEDs hitting the convoys that I was riding in when I deployed. But I was a logistics officer by school training. And so even though I was, you know, in combat, it was, you know, in a way that wasn't at least foreseen by the people who made policy around women prior to the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. This created, you know, some cascading effects when it comes to, you know, whether women's wartime service was appropriately acknowledged the way that a male peer would. I think there are many women whose service, and especially some women who really served with distinction and valor in combat, did get acknowledged, but many women who got overlooked and maybe weren't given the awards or recognition that, you know, a man who was running the same platoon or the same company would otherwise have gotten. But, you know, hopefully times have changed, and I think it is important that we continue to lean into this conversation, in part because it does come down to not just policy change, but leadership as well. And, you know, step one is getting more women into combat designated roles, but also into combatant leadership posts as well, which you're seeing a few women, you know, today serving in. And that was also key to getting, we just celebrated the first woman who's a member of the Joint Chiefs. And having women continue to ascend into those types of leadership roles, I think, will help women fully get the recognition that they deserve and will have earned the next time we go to war.
Oh, absolutely. And it means a lot, not only to the service member, but I've certainly seen it over the decades, how much it means to the veteran's family, the veteran's community, their associates. So not getting the recognition has this ripple effect that can be interpreted as, well, I was something less than, and that's certainly not the case. So I'm glad to hear that it's still an issue that people are leaning in on. One more issue, and I promise this is the last one. We talked about it when we started, that I wanted to get some comments on because of the recruiting misses that every branch of service is suffering at the moment. You talked earlier, one of the unique things about IAVA is its members were all volunteers. We obviously have to have volunteers at full strength for our military. It becomes a national security issue. So give us, I know you've been talking and thinking about this issue. Give us some thoughts on how does the military and the country do a better job of recruiting into these spaces?
Well, I certainly don't have all of the answers, but because this is something that I've personally been spending time on, that I feel a sense of responsibility, as you noted, leading the largest national veterans organization that represents exclusively volunteers, that I feel a sense of responsibility to be a part of the solution in. You know, I think first and foremost, I think service needs to be hip. You know, I think culturally, instead of just like, you know, otherizing the troops, you know, I wish we could foster in young people a desire to be one of them. And I think that can happen two ways. I think it can happen just because America is what it is through Hollywood. You know,
sure, it's cultural.
The Air Force will tell you that they saw a little bit of a bump after Top Gun Maverick came out. But I also think as veterans, especially because a lot of veterans that I know aren't necessarily like self-promoters who will like talk about themselves or their service, I think we need to get more comfortable doing it. We are fewer and fewer in numbers. The American people know less and less of us. And I think, you know, How many people do you know who went into a profession because that's what their parents did or somebody else who they knew?
Absolutely. Every, you know, doctor, lawyer, baker, candlestick maker.
Exactly. And so maybe your parents didn't serve, although, you know, the military today is a good example of like families who are serving. You know, it's sons and daughters, brothers and sisters are making up a disproportionate amount of the military, even with this few of people serving these days. But the more people who know us and see us and who can get familiar with what it is to serve, the more we can like get young people in America curious about what that might be for them, whether it's a career or whether it's, you know, just a part of their, you know, adult lived experience. And that also gives like the conversation allows people to be more curious and interested and maybe even see themselves in uniform, but it also allows them to understand some of the benefits that can come from service, whether it's the leadership training that I got or the education that I got, you know?
And I think that's one of the things we need to all talk more about is that that growth, those things we got, the intangibles we got when we served, that kind of carried on through life. Maybe it's showing up on time and realizing you're going to have to work hard and not everything's going to be 100% fair. But those are all life skills, right, that you have to learn to keep moving forward. And you can learn them in the military, and you can serve a higher purpose in the military. If, you know, it's something that, if you love your freedoms, somebody's got to protect those freedoms, and I don't know that we do a great job of expressing those ideas. And I think it'd be a wonderful thing for IAVA to keep promoting out there, and that is the real value of service to people.
Even if you get out, and there are many people who are career soldiers, I don't know many vets who don't still carry a part of their service experience with them and hold it near and dear to their heart. Even people who, you know, went out guns a-blazing, you know, not looking back, they still have, you know, battle buddies or friends from that time or memories from that time, whether you serve peacetime or in wartime, that profoundly change you for the rest of your life. And I think anybody who wants to serve should consider it. And I think veterans should be encouraging young people to consider service, but also non-veterans. You know, I hate hearing stories about parents who sometimes think that their kids are too good for serving in uniform. I don't know where that mentality comes from, but, you know, parents, even if you come from a very privileged background, if you have a kid who says, you know, I feel like I'm being called to enlist in the Marines, you should support them doing that. It is very inspiring, especially to see children from privileged backgrounds to want to roll up their sleeves and serve something greater than themselves and think themselves no better than the other enlisted Marines, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And you'll get if you do that, if you join up, you're going to meet people from all across the country, all kinds of different approaches and experiences in life, and that will make you a richer person as a result.
Could you imagine what our country would be like today if more people were stepping up to serve a common cause and meeting people from different backgrounds? Like, I feel like some of the problems we're facing in our country today could be ameliorated if more people served together, whether it's in military service or in other ways, towards a common mission and a common goal that worked to make this country a better place than it was yesterday.
Absolutely.
You know?
It would create a commonality, not build barriers in between folks. Well, we certainly appreciate the extra time that Allison Jaslow, CEO of IAVA, gave us. Your mission that you're supporting is really important, and we are glad to be able to, you know, broadcast it out a little further and help bring folks to you. You got an easy website for folks to find you. Why don't you give them that if they want to know more about IAVA?
Sure. You can visit us at IAVA.org. We are a nonprofit that grinds away advocating on our generation of veterans, please visit IAVA.org and learn more about us. And if you so choose, donate in support of our work.
Allison, thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me, Jim.
Let's have a quick update on the Air and Space Forces Association.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Brigadier General retired Doug Odie Slocum, who is going to talk to us about the Michigan Air and Space Forces Association. General, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, it's great to be here, Jim. I look forward to talking with you. How are you doing today?
We're doing great, and this is some new things going on that we want to share with the Veteran Radio audience, not only here in the state of Michigan, but really this is affiliated with the AFA, Air and Space Forces Association, nationally. Tell us a little bit about your career in the military, how many years you served, and I know that you've had a pretty distinguished career, and we don't have time to go through it all, but I want people to understand from where your enthusiasm for AFA comes from.
Well, sure, and thanks for the opportunity. And no, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this topic, but I was blessed to spend 35 years in uniform. One of the greatest things was being able to serve some of the most amazing men and women you'd ever want to meet. And if there's one part of my career that I would have to say is the highlight, it's a lot of opportunities to run what I would call caring for people types of programs. Although I spent my career as a fighter pilot, I also got to be involved with many things associated with safety, suicide prevention, resiliency, those types of things. And then, of course, being the commander out at Michigan's hometown air base at Selfridge, where we were able to implement some real-world, down-to-earth, community-based types of caring for our people programs. And I tell you, that's just the highlight. Okay, well, I started off in the love of my life. I call her the F-4 Phantom. The legacy the platform there, that fighter jet. Then I converted over to the F-16, and I spent most of my career flying that, more than 4,000 hours in the different models of the F-16. And then I got to top it off out at Selfridge, being a pilot of the A-10 Warthog with the big bad gun that does all the neat things that it does supporting the ground troops.
We've had more than one program on the A-10s. It seems like every few years they say, we're going to get rid of it. And we have another program about the vital importance of the A-10 to the ground game. But again, we could get all of our time spent on your interesting military career and the different airframes you've flown. I want folks to understand that's kind of where your passion comes from for your involvement with the Air and Space Forces Association. It's hard to get Space Forces in there. My mind just wants to go into the Air Force Association.
Well, they changed it about a year and a half ago, so it still kind of has a hard time coming out of my mouth, too. Plus, we still use the AFA abbreviation. To add Air and Space Forces in there just to let everybody know we represent both of those branches of our military now.
Well, and that's something we need to talk about more on what Space Force is all about. But AFA is really supposed to be the force behind the force. Tell us about the purpose of AFA.
You know, that is a grand question that I don't think we spend enough time talking about. That essentially after World War II, as the very founders of air power, the Army Air Corps that was about to become the U.S. Air Force, realized that they needed to have a voice beyond those who are wearing the uniform, because those that are in uniform are very constrained on what they can say, how they can advocate. So Jimmy Doolittle, from the Doolittle Raid, General Doolittle, was the one who was actually one of the primary founders of the Air Force Association. And it was started to be the voice behind the force, the ones that can talk to Congress, that can keep us from reducing our strength for, like, example, we did between World War I and World War II, where we pretty much ended up having to start everything over again. So the very founders of the Air Force founded the Air Force Association to be that voice, to be that advocate, to go out there, talk to the community, talk to Congress. Basically, we have three verbs. It's about education, advocacy, and support. Teaching people about the Air and Space Forces, advocating for things that they need to be able to be that dominant force that they are, and supporting the men and women who do or have worn that uniform.
And General, this is an organization at a national level. Who's it open up to? Is it just you general officer types?
Oh, absolutely not. We are open to the public. You don't even have to have an Air Force affiliation to be part of the Air and Space Forces Association. Anybody can go to AFA.org, you know, the website. There's a membership tab. There's lots of different ways to get involved, to join. The resources, we're the think tank of the Air Force, the advocacy arm for the Air Force. There are so many different resources and ways to get engaged at this point. But the key, the first step, is that membership, which is easy to do, inexpensive, afa.org.
Well, I want to turn our attention to the specific work that you're involved in as president of the Michigan Air and Space Forces Association. There are AFA groups or chapters, whatever you want to call them, all over the world. There's reported to be a couple of hundred of such AFA chapters, and you're in the process of helping build out the Michigan AFA organization. So talk to us a little bit about the Michigan AFA.
You bet. You know, like a lot of these advocacy organizations around the country, I think that inherently right now there are some struggles that these organizations are going through. So it's very nice here in Michigan. We've kind of flipped the script a little bit on this whole thing. We have monthly get-togethers. I wouldn't call them necessarily meetings because we don't talk internal business. But this is how we engage with the public, how we engage with our membership. Primarily right now, which a lot of times, well, one, it's always a great meal, whether it's a breakfast or a lunch that we put together.
Yeah, you gotta have food in there, right?
Oh, you gotta get the food, the coffee, those types of things in there. But then the networking, you get to meet some of the most amazing people from the state of Michigan in all different aspects, you know, the very diverse from, you know, political involvement, community leaders, business leaders, veterans, all that. And in our Sterling Heights location, we have between 80 and 100 people every month that we get together. And then we dive into different topics. You know, after what happened in the Middle East, we very specifically jumped into, let's talk about Gaza. Let's talk about Israel and the Middle East. Not only did I get an opportunity to kind of frame the discussion, but then we brought in the senior defense attaché from the embassy in Israel. And then we brought in an Israeli general to come in and talk to us. And this is just one example of current, relevant information that will leave people with a greater understanding of our air and space forces and what's going on in the world than when they walked in the door. This model has been very effective. We continue to grow, gain memberships. We're opening new locations, starting down in Ann Arbor, and we're looking at expanding both west and north here in the state. And we're going to jump into the virtual. We're going to start doing virtual events every month, and then even expanding that possibly into a podcast here in the near future that will allow us to touch more topics, bring in more expertise, and just help people out, whether they're trying to raise the business or just be part supporters of the men and women that wear the uniform.
Well, it's so important these days to try to get word out and educate the general public about what it is our air and space forces do and what needs they have. So I think this is a really exciting time to be expanding the footprint, the geographic footprint of Michigan AFA, and moving into the virtual world as we've all kind of become so used to Zoom or Teams or what have you to attend a program that we might not otherwise be able to drive to. So is that the thinking, to reach that larger class that way?
Well, the way people engage nowadays is completely different. Some like in person, some like the virtual, some like a podcast, some through social media. So we're trying to meet people that the way they communicate. So we're using all of these to be able to reach out and tell this story about our Air and Space Forces Association. So LinkedIn, certainly, and Facebook, we're involved there. And like we said, through the virtual options that are coming up here shortly, as well as podcasts, emails, et cetera. Communication is the tough one, and that's what we're pushing out there, is to get the word out.
You can hear my full interview with
the president of the Michigan AFA, Brigadier General Odie Slocum, retired. You can find more on their website at afa-mi.org and check them out. We also always want to thank our VSO sponsors. So thanks to the VVA Kettles Chapter 310 in Ann Arbor, the VFW Graff O'Hara Post 423 in Ann Arbor, American Legion Prescott and Post 45 in Ann Arbor. You can help us out on Veterans Radio by donating. Go to our website, veteransradio.org, and help us out. Throw a little money our way to keep us on the air. This is a nonprofit organization, and your money is used to bring you this kind of programming at least twice a week. We'd like to spread the word to different affiliates, radio stations around the country, and boost our internet podcasting, but we need your help to do that. This is Jim Fossona. It's been a privilege to be your host today on Veterans Radio. Dale Throneberry will be back next week, and we'll bring you more great stories of interest to veterans and their friends and family members. We always have a benefits program at the last Sunday of every month, so if you have a question, throw it to us by email. We'll try to answer it. Veterans benefits, whether they be disability or health care, can be kind of confusing. So throw us the question. We'll try to answer it on air or call on in at that time. But it's always a privilege to serve you, those that served our country, as we like to say. It's our obligation to continue our service even when we become civilians, and to remember all those who are currently serving. So until next time on Veterans Radio, I am Jim Fossone. Dale Throneberry will be back again next week. And until then, you are dismissed.